Okay, it is August 4th, 2010. We are back at the offices of the OCC in Washington, D.C. to interview Mr. Dave Roeder.
Doug
Roeder, you see? I get the last name right, the first name wrong. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And I'm staring at your card while I misstate your first name. Mr. Roeder, my name's Chris Seifer. This is Al Crego and Clara Moraine. We're all with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We were established by a statute called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that was passed last year in 2009 and tasks us with figuring out the various causes of the financial crisis. And that statute tells us to look at various possible contributing causes to the financial crisis, including the role of subprime mortgages, non-traditional mortgage loans, the role of securitization, the issue of too big to fail. It tells us to look at institutions that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of exceptional government assistance, which Wachovia almost was.
The first systemic risk determination.
Right. So that's why we are looking at both Countrywide and Wachovia. That's why, of course, we're interested in talking to folks at the OCC, and that's why we're interested in talking to you. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. As we briefly discussed before we put on the tape, I want to talk to you about Countrywide and Wachovia, but before we get to that, could you, so we have it for the record, just briefly summarize your educational work experience, starting with college, please.
Okay. I graduated from the University of Cincinnati in 1979 and in Bachelor's Business Administration with a major in finance. I was a co-op student at Cincinnati, and actually during my days as a co-op student became a financial intern at the OCC. So my career started at the OCC in October of 1977. It's been continuous since then. I went to the Stonier Graduate School of Banking, which was sponsored by the ABA, hosted by the University of Delaware, and did a thesis as a part of that, but it's not a full MBA, just a graduate work in the field of commercial banking. I've worked since 77 in virtually all areas of the OCC, so this October will be 33 years. Mm-hmm. I've been in my current position as Senior Deputy Comptroller for Large Bank Supervision since October of 01, so coming up on 9 years. And prior to that, I was a Deputy Comptroller for Large Bank Supervision, helped reorganize what we now call our large bank program in the summer of 1997. Prior to that, I was in the field as an examiner in charge of a couple of large financial institutions. I was a field manager overseeing community banks in the New England area, and I was a problem bank analyst, a regional bank analyst, and a basic national bank examiner. So I've kind of touched all the bases from a supervision standpoint at the OCC.
Congratulations on 33 years.
Thank you.
So if you could, I'm going to want to focus on probably the time since you've been senior deputy comptroller, since that was back in 2001. And let's, if you can, in that time frame, and when we're looking at Wachovia, I'm going to want to focus, let's talk about that institution first, and sort of the 05, 06 at the earliest and going forward. Before we, in that time frame, before we get to Wachovia, can you just sort of describe to me the reporting structure here, who you're reporting to and who's underneath you?
As Senior Deputy Comptroller, I report directly to the Comptroller of the currency. I'm a member of the Executive Committee. And basically, my responsibility is to oversee what we define at OCC as the largest national banks. Currently, that's 15 institutions. They tend to be institutions that are at least $100 billion in consolidated assets, or Basel II institutions where there are foreign parents involved. So in other words, we've got most of them are large, they're all U.S. Banks, but some of them are owned by foreign companies like HSBC or Union Bank Cal by the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi. But anyway, I also have responsibility for international banking, which includes our program as well as our oversight of federal branches and agencies. So that's anyway, so I report to the comptroller. That's my primary responsibility, and then I have four deputy comptrollers under me, two of which split that portfolio of 15 banks. One handles the international, one handles what I call risk management operations for large banks, more of a horizontal analytical role in major programs like shared national credits. And then the examiners in charge, who are in each bank with teams of examiners, report to those deputy comptrollers.
Okay, you mentioned that two of the four deputies cover the 15. Right. What are the other two?
The other two, one handles international banking, is actually deputy comptroller for international banking supervision. So all the Fed branches and agencies, and then all of our international program policy initiatives are handled by that deputy. And then the fourth deputy handles data analytics, broad program procedure analysis. And then we do horizontals, horizontals being a common look at all institutions. For example, we did a non-traditional mortgage horizontal across all large banks in 07 and 08 on heels of the interagency guidance that was issued. We basically went out and tested using the same procedures and the same team of people how each of the large banks had implemented that guidance. So he runs, you know, programs like that, working obviously with the portfolio people. The portfolio deputies, they're the nuts and bolts with the EICs of doing the direct bank supervision. So I rely on them for, you know, in case of Countrywide, Wachovia, the deputy comptroller and that EIC are my two primary players of understanding and directing the supervision activities of that, those institutions.
And that one deputy comptroller, would, is that the deputy comptroller that runs risk management operations for large banks? Would that be the main person you're relying on for Wachovia and Countrywide?
No, actually, it'd be the easiest way. You know, there's two deputy comptrollers for supervision that split the two banks, or the 15 banks.
Right.
So one has eight, one has seven.
Oh, okay.
Those are the people that I rely on, the engagement with our examiners, bank management, and the overall supervision of the institutions.
Okay, then I misunderstood something. Yep. I thought when you said that you had two that covered 15 banks, you had two. You said there was an international person and a risk management operations.
Right.
Where did I get lost?
They're the two that don't have any bank, direct bank responsibilities.
Okay.
And then there are two that have
I see. All right, so these are these folks down here. Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you something generally. As I said in the beginning, you know, we're looking at Wachovia anyway, mm-hmm. not Countrywide, to look at the issue of too big to fail, because that was the first systemic risk exception approval. Is there generally within the OCC systemic risk supervision policies or procedures for the systemically important institutions? How does the OCC identify systemically important institutions? How do they supervise them? What's different, you know, for those as opposed to others?
We don't have specific procedures that are titled systemically important. Our large bank program, and the fact that it's only 15 banks, by its nature, is our what I call designation of institutions that are the most prominent substantive banks to the national banking system. So we don't, we have a fairly well-defined program and procedures that address how to supervise large banks, but we don't distinguish those banks as systemically important. Now, with that said, in the 15 banks, there's certainly differentiation. I mean, take what I call the four mega banks, Citi, JPMC, Bank of America, and Wells. You could put Wachovia in that when Wachovia was self-standing. Those institutions and the activities that they were involved in were head and shoulders above the rest of the institutions. So, you know, we execute our supervision by, focusing in on those institutions within the 15 that certainly carry the brunt of the risk and the activity, particularly market activities. Mm-hmm. But we don't really have a separate or distinguished program that's just for systemically important institutions. If we kind of basically say those 15 are significant among all other national banks, and so we put special centralized attention on them.
Okay. And other than putting centralized attention on these, did you mean these four mega banks or all 15?
All 15.
Okay.
But where we differentiate, I've got resident examiners. So I've got basically 450 examiners that spend time in those 15 banks. They're dedicated. Many of them are specialists. And they're assigned. They report to the examiners in charge of each bank. But for the larger, more complex the bank, the more people and the more seniority and specialists. So, for example, at Citibank, we've got 50 people there all the time. Where at Harris Bank, owned by Bank of Montreal, it's under $100 billion in size, I've got, six, seven people. So we distinguish, and it's all about what we're doing each day at those institutions. Obviously, at Citi, it's much wider breadth, more focused on issues, so I need more people, more talent there than I need at Harris Bank. But both are centralized entities that report in here because of their size, significance. In the case of Harris, it's international connection.
I take it the EIC is a resident examiner,
yes,
too?
Yes, yes. And we rotate those people every 5 years, so they're under an agreement, a formal agreement with when they take the position, then in 5 years they rotate out.
Those people being the EIC?
Yes, okay. Right. But without using the word systemically significant, we feature those 15, and the reason why we've centralized them here in Washington is so we can have reasonable consistency, uniformity. We can streamline communication, and what I mean by that, a good example, say of Wachovia, is where we have issues. You've got your examiner in charge and the deputy comptroller who work as a duo, kind of really doing the primary work. And then there's me and the comptroller. So we can get issues of prominence, whether it's initiated by us or initiated by the bank, to the top of the house pretty quickly.
And just, I think, I know we talked to the EIC for Wachovia very recently.
Dave Wilson.
And who was the deputy comptroller for Wachovia
in this? At the time, it was Mike Brosnan.
Okay, right, and I've seen that name. Okay, so understanding that you have this large institution group of these 15 banks, let me back up.
Okay.
When I looked, I've seen the memos by the Richmond Fed and by the FDIC on the recommendation to invoke the systemic risk exception. And the focus on of those memos and in the board meetings that we've seen on that was what impact would there be if we did a normal liquidation least cost resolution that would result in uninsured creditors taking hits?
Right.
What would that mean for them? What would that mean for confidence in the banking system in general? What would that mean in terms of impact on the economy of the United States and on the economy of the world, since Wachovia had a lot of international presence? So since I've seen that, I was wondering, and I've been asking folks like you from the various agencies, for these big bank groups, is there some type of, you know, systemic supervision procedure to have a better feel for counterparty exposure should, God forbid, you know, the time come where you have to make these kinds of decisions?
Not in a formal, there's not a formal set of procedures. I mean, we've learned over the course of the crisis that, you know, particularly on an interagency basis, and certainly it's featured in now the legislation that was just passed, that, you know, there's a clearly systemically important institutions need to be framed, understood, standards and expectations put forth in a clear way that, quite frankly, are different, may be different than any other institution. That's developed over time. We didn't go into it with that kind of picture or roadmap. Each agency, for us, we had what we call our large bank supervision booklet. That was the everything to how to supervise a large bank, whether it was Citibank or Harris Bank. And while there, you know, we're certainly, we tailor our plan of attack for each institution based on how it operates, its complexity and all that, so that not every plan's the same. It's the same basic program approach to them, whether it's Citi or Harris. Now, what we've learned is that, besides what's introduced in the legislation, is that for the very, very large banks, they're just, you know, kind of communication, networking, horizontal type things that are important because, take derivatives, you know, the five largest institutions, you know, dominate, you know, they're about 99% of the derivatives market. So, as regulators, we look at those in a special way and focus all of our attention. But we haven't really yet sat down and written systemically important standards.
For example, one of the things I haven't read the new legislation, so I don't know everything in there, but some of the things I've read in the press, you know, since the financial crisis, is this whole idea of a living will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my understanding of a living will is sort of the, God forbid, that you get in trouble. Yeah. It's sort of the roadmap of how we unwind transactions and who the counterparties are and things like that. I mean, I guess my first question is my understanding correct generally that that's what a living will is?
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that we've learned, I mean, we went into this with no real, you know, grandiose scheme of, you know, what happens if one of these things, you know, falls apart. I mean, certainly Fiducia, you know, put forth, you know, the least cost resolution concept, et cetera, and set forth the systemic risk determination, you know, which until Wachovia weekend had never been exercised by the FDIC or the Board of Governors. And so, you know, one of the things during the crisis, which leads to the more focused structure on the topic in the legislation, is we just, these large companies, they're, know, particularly with a lot of non-banking activity, it's very difficult to figure out how to resolve them other than, you know, straight bankruptcy or something like that, which is highly disruptive to the marketplace. You know, you can maybe carve out the insured deposit institution, which is what I'm worried about, but there's so many other moving pieces in these companies that it's just extremely difficult to do one-off kind of resolution. So the idea with these living wills, in part, is to kind of start understanding the full structure of an organization and laying out possible contingencies so that as a company becomes stressed, you can, both bank management and the regulator can begin to focus attention on ways to diminish and mitigate a resolution, so to speak, as deterioration's occurring. So you don't wait until the big crash occurs and then you gotta spend a weekend figuring out what the heck to do. So the idea is to kind of have a process defined where you can, you know, as stress is induced, you know, you can make judgments on, okay, maybe this set of businesses can be sold. Let's get those, you know, carved out, or there's specific funding that's vulnerable, so let's see if we can find replacement funding for that, just to try to avoid the worst case scenario. You know, that's clearly something we've learned over the last couple of years that we really didn't have in place. Bank, you know, we expected banks to have contingency planning, but not to the degree that is envisioned with these living wills or resolution plans that the FDIC will be working with institutions on in the coming months. So
are there now like new sections or additions to existing sections of the large bank supervision booklet?
There will be. It's to come. Mm-hmm. You know, as you know, any regulations or other procedures are defined here. I mean, the FDIC is working on resolution planning, and I think out of the legislation, one of the charges the Federal Reserve has is they, with consultation with, you know, us as a banking regulator and others for these large companies, they've got it to introduce standards, new standards for complex companies. So as those things get written and decided, I'm sure they'll influence a change in our handbook and our guidance for examiners and kind of the roadmap we expect them to follow. Mm-hmm. But that's not done yet. I mean, it's kind of, you know, still on a drawing board to be delivered. You know, some of the stuff has time frames, but basically it's in the months ahead.
Right. So let me ask a further probing question.
Okay.
on that. And in the OCC exam reports and other documents, you know, we have seen reference to when in 2008, particularly after they announced a $9 billion net loss and for 2Q8 consolidated loss, not for the bank, you know, there was much more attention being paid to funding counterparties, and it's even written, I think, in the exam report that, you know, some institutions were reducing their exposure to Wachovia. So we do see, or I do see the OCC paying more attention to liquidity and funding counterparties. Mm-hmm. In the memos by the FDIC and the Richmond Fed recommending the systemic risk exception, they actually like have, and one of them at least has like a sort of a matrix box with type of counterparty, whether it's a broker-dealer, whether it's a mutual fund, and the various types of liabilities across the top, just to sort of get a snapshot picture of what are the systemic implications by at least grouping of creditor, if not individual creditor. And I'm wondering if, you know, prior to the crisis anyway, if the OCC, you know, did that kind of an analysis, you know, would it have information or examination procedures to say we need to know either by type of counterparty what types of liabilities they're holding of, I guess, the bank, certainly in the first instance, but maybe even broader than the bank, even though the Fed's doing the holding company, you know, to have an idea of what you would have to deal with if the horrible things came to pass that eventually came to pass.
In our examination procedures, we've got all the various areas, risk categories, activities, so liquidity, funds management being the one, or credit management or trading activities. All those things are guided by a lot of procedures, and then the supervision is overseen by people who are our best examiners in those areas. So what they do in their individual banks, they would have a pretty complete understanding of what counterparties, major fund providers, the behavior of wholesale funding versus retail funding, short-term, long-term, all aspects of that. And would have been, we actually have a procedure that we invoked in August 07 where in the largest banks we ask for weekly liquidity monitoring and updates that were fed in here, and then we assembled a view of what the market was doing in a summary orient. And then to the extent certain nuances were developing, we could explore those. So we wouldn't have necessarily, kind of written the roadmap or the diagram or the picture diagram, but basically we're very much enjoined with the FDIC, or excuse me, the Fed and these large companies understanding the dynamics. So if you go into any of our banks, our examiners, an examiner in charge who would have been in that institution, so Wachovia, so Dave Wilson and a couple of the people he had monitoring liquidity would have had a pretty good feel for what the basic concentrations were, reliances were on wholesale fund providers, counterparties, et cetera. I mean, what happened at Wachovia was something we saw happen at Citi and we saw happen at others. Bear Stearns had this issue, Lehman had the issue, Morgan Stanley had, everybody with Goldman kind of had the issue, and that is counterparties ran and large providers ran. It was this time it was more of a versus what we saw in the late 80s, early 90s. Because of the size of these organizations, they had a lot of retail deposits, but much of their structure was funded with wholesale short-term funds. And so we had to go into a whole different mode of monitoring here. Retail deposits can run, but it takes some time, and usually they don't run in a couple days like that, maybe in a small bank, but not a big bank. Wholesale funding, though, where you have a lot of overnight stuff, but the crisis, the term markets shortened or weren't available. The lack of confidence and fear, it was like lighting, brush fire. It went quick, and that's what we saw at Wachovia. So we understood the vulnerabilities around what I call wholesale funding versus retail. We, throughout the crisis, though, were regularly surprised at how quick things went. So even though Wachovia announced in that summer of 08 the earnings issues, and certainly the market was differentiating them, their debt spreads had widened, et cetera, even earlier in that year, between National City and Bear Stearns, and even going back to real late fourth quarter 07 when Citi and B of A had their huge CDO losses. Mm-hmm. The markets were starting to differentiate, and so we paid close attention to counterparties all the way through. But as we got towards the end of the summer, we got to the government, the GSC issue, and Labor Day 08, and that September, it's where everything became dark, and each weekend was something new, and investor confidence withdrew. It withdrew in the U.S., it withdrew in the world, and it just got dicier. So, but we were monitoring that all the way through, making sure institutions were doing what they could to keep ample funding sources there. Some were going to the Federal Reserve. Some were tapping the Federal Home Loan Banks heavy. We made sure their collateral was arranged the right way. But it was increasingly shorter term. And for institutions that had a stigma in the market, like Wachovia, unfortunately, in the case of Wachovia, you know, the option arms and then the WaMu failure that was preceded by, you know, the AIG and the Lehman deal, it just squeezed them quickly. I mean, it just literally within 24 hours, the counterparties ran. And that's what triggered Wachovia to basically throw their hands up in there and say, we've got to find a partner or more capital, we got to do it quick. So,
That actually answered several of the questions I was going to follow up with. So thank you. And I actually wanted to follow. One of the things that we see in the documents and that we've heard from other people we've talked to is that while we certainly see, as is reported in the August 08 report, that some of the funding counterparties were reducing their exposures.
You're talking about the ROE, the Wachovia ROE.
Document one from the...
Okay. This morning.
From the Wilson interview, yes. So we see them, you know, reducing exposures, reducing tenors, increasing price, probably increasing collateral requirements on repos and Federal Home Loan Bank advances and all those kind of fun things. But we don't see the inability to fund. Mm-hmm. We just see that it's more expensive and shorter term. And it looks like that the quote-unquote run and the liquidity crisis in terms of Wachovia didn't really occur until September 26th, the day after WaMu went down. Can you comment on that and tell me if I'm right or wrong or some of both?
Yeah, actually, you know, the report was accurate, you know, talking about the concerns around liquidity funding given the issues they had with credit problems in the mortgage area and they had, you know, in their investment division, you know, CDO kind of stuff, variable rate notes, things like that that were particularly vulnerable in the market where they had valuation write-downs and large losses. Up the week before that Friday or that weekend, they actually, there was some retail deposit line. I think they were like, you know, 10 days ahead of what I recall, 10 days ahead of that 26, they actually lost about $11 billion in retail deposits. So the name was suffering itself even in the retail arena. Now, they did some other things with retail broker CDs to help offset some of that decline. But you could see the funding pressure. So their spreads were widening. There was a general outflow of some retail deposits, so the word was out, you know, that, you know, these guys, you know, the media had them targeted as, you know, boy, they got this big, you know, chain around their neck with the option arm, you know, the thrifts, and things were just getting darker in the sense of, you know, the Lehman thing, the AIG. The other thing that happened that I think sparked it was the weekend. So you had Lehman like on the 16th, then you had a weekend like the 22nd or the week before the Wachovia weekend. Well, that weekend would feature Goldman and Morgan Stanley being rumored as takeover candidates and looking at Wachovia. And word got out that they backed, you know, no deal was done, and you know, there was press around the big hole that existed at Wachovia, you know, predominantly the value. There was a lot of investment banking logic in that would suggest that you marked the balance sheet and there's a $60, $70, $80 billion hole to fill. You know, that's not how the mechanics work, but that was the run in the media, and investment bankers, they only know fair value. So But the idea was their name was in play, and so even on the retail side, you started to see funds moving, not at a catastrophic pace, but certainly a sign that they were losing traction. So when WAMU closed that Thursday night, the next day, that 26th, their five-year CDS spread, their debt spread, doubled in 24 hours. It went from like 800, which is huge. Most banks are in the low 100s. The riskier ones at 200, 250 right now. So, I mean, they're at 800. They're there with Morgan Stanley and a few others. And it went to 1,600 on that Friday. So, I mean, it's just, those are huge jumps. And so they depict, you know, the names getting seized in some way. And what happened during that Friday, more after lunch, counterparties started pulling out. And we don't talk to the counterparties, but you know, I had intelligence from at least one other large bank and our exam staff late that Friday afternoon that the Wachovia name was under seizure by the market.
And who was that conversation with?
Our EIC at J.P. Morgan Chase.
And who's
basically,
that?
Basically, Scott Waterhouse. And basically what that means is, you know, he was hearing noise from J.P., who were getting approached by Wachovia counterparties saying, we want you guys to take us out of the Wachovia deal because we're not staying with the Wachovia name.
They were asking J.P. Morgan Chase to
innovate
their trades,
right,
I guess.
Right, exactly. So, and actually I got that call from him an hour before I got the call from the CFO and general counsel at Wachovia indicating the board had met. They were highly concerned about their funding ability heading into the following week, and the board had charged management to seek capital if they could and or a merger over the weekend.
Okay, so let me follow up, because
yep.
I have seen,
yep.
actually, I mean, just from the public documents, I think there was like a $30 billion decline in deposits in the third quarter of 2008. And from, if I'm remembering this correctly, from the liquidity reports we've seen from Wachovia, or I guess from Wells, I think I even saw an $11 billion reduction in the month of July.
Yeah.
So I've seen the deposit, and that's a consolidated report, I believe, so we're not just talking the bank. But since it was deposits, I suspect it was primarily the bank. So I've seen that $30 billion deposit outflow, $11 billion of which I believe was in July. I'm waiting for the subsequent reports to give me August and September, since this report only went through July. But what I'm getting at from sort of the too big to fail perspective is, while we're seeing that, and we're aware of, you know, yes, the increased concern as Lehman goes down on the 15th and AIG gets bailed out on the 16th, and over the weekend apparently Goldman and Morgan Stanley decide they're not going to buy Wachovia and more bad news, et cetera. But not until WAMU goes down on the 25th.
Right.
Have we seen in the documents or heard from other interviews that the next day, and for whatever reason, not until after lunch, that's when the counterparties actually start to, at a more catastrophic level, you know, start to demand, say, we're not going to roll, we want our money back, and to the point where, there are legitimate concerns about, are we going to be able to fund ourselves here?
Well, you had, you know, I think one of the things, you know, it's hard to say which item, you know, maybe was the driver. I mean, one of the things that WAMU spooked the world markets on was when they saw that debt holders at WAMU got shaved in the deal. So, you know, now. Yeah, just that really sent shockwaves around the world, because there are a lot of debt holders that aren't U.S. based; they're, you know, Europe, other places, and so that when that was you know, out there. You know, that, it just, it was a, just a very unsettling tone and piece of information for the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, I kind of, my view was, particularly after Labor Day, you know, just Fridays became a very tenuous point in time because no one knew what was going to happen that weekend. And so there was increasing pent-up anxiety for, okay, it's the weekend, it's Friday afternoon, what the hell's going to happen this weekend, and who's next? And so it's just a, it's a combination of that anxiety, fear, lack of confidence, that, you know, I just tipped the scale especially hard the morning and really the day after Washington Beach.
Did you ever hear from anyone, whether it's internally or externally, that up until WAMU went down, there was a belief that Wachovia is too big to fail? I mean, yes, a week or so ago they let Lehman go down, and clearly by the next day they learned their lesson and bailed out AIG. They're not going to let a big financial institution die, given what they saw happen with Lehman, but then WAMU goes down.
No, I, you know, to be honest with you, you know, clearly with WAMU, with Lehman being allowed to fail and WAMU obviously being put into receivership, you know, Wachovia was twice the size of you know, of WAMU, but I honestly, I never had a conversation with anyone that would have labeled Wachovia as too big to fail, or can I say we were thinking that? You know, to be honest with you, absent the pay option arm issue, we thought Wachovia, you know, they had a, you know, well, they were well capitalized by regulatory standards, certainly under earnings pressure, you know, due to the growing problems in the mortgages and the continued valuation write-downs occurring, you know, out of their investment credit structure programs. But we didn't, you know, we never considered them as, you know, I never considered them really as a failure candidate. You know, a week before that weekend, you know, we were in conversation with the FDIC, who was actually presenting to its board, or actually to its chairman, not its board, that they, you know, saw Wachovia as a three-rated bank, concurred with our assessment. So no one really saw it as an imminent failure, or some institution that warranted special attention. That developed, quite frankly, during the weekend, and certainly was decided when we got to Sunday evening that it was systemically important. And I don't recall any conversation about the pure dollar size of Wachovia. It was more, it was like, okay, this one's really big compared to the earlier ones. It's really a, it's a top five bank, and we can't let this thing go unattended. I mean, it's just, I think it was more just a consensus building that, you know, this has franchise value, and so, you know, let's find some way to get through this. And I think the way that was found was to treat it as a systemic risk thing. You know, certainly, other, you know, it's identified in those documents. The conversation captured the concern about world markets. Europe had three institutions that were being resolved that weekend. And I really think the administration was concerned about opening the markets on that Monday with an unresolved issue, having experienced the Lehman AIG thing. So I think there was just simply a lot of timing pressure to get something done and not let the institution linger. And I think as we were kind of each weekend learning on the fly, so to speak, of how to deal with these things, I think the idea was, okay, we got two interested institutions, Wells and Citi. Let's you know, we really thought Wells was going to do an unassisted deal, which, you know, would have even made a systemic risk thing moot. But they decided Sunday that they weren't going to do that. And, you know, the principals, you know, decided to not leave the weekend with the Wachovia unresolved. So, you know, there was the decision to entertain bids from both city and Wells with government assistance attached.
Do you know why Wells decided that they didn't want to do an unassisted bid?
I think it was very straightforward, you know, based on my knowledge, and that was they're a very disciplined acquirer. They were highly interested in Wachovia, and it's like a fish laying in the water. You know, Wachovia was going belly up, and you know, there were a couple sharks in the water that went after them. Basically, Wells saw, you know, strategic value in the thing. They backed off because they could not complete due diligence, particularly around the large commercial real estate portfolio and the leverage portfolio, which Wells never did leverage lending, really. And the commercial real estate projects, the little they could see, they could only see stuff in a data room. They couldn't go touch it, talk to loan officers or anything. So they're just kind of trying to do an $800 billion transaction through a data room. That's just highly unusual. And they basically could not get satisfied with the true risk of loss in a big chunk of those assets and said, we need more time. And I think basically it came down to, if you, government, want a resolution to Wachovia by Sunday night or before markets open Monday, we'll do it on a government-assisted basis. We're not going to do it on an we're not going to take the risk on an unassisted basis unless you give us more time. And basically, the decision was made not to provide more time. Therefore, city enters ready to do a transaction. And out of the two, quote, government-assisted bids, city was awarded the transaction.
And what's your understanding of why Wells then subsequently came back with an unassisted bid?
You know, personal opinion, I think.
Well, do you know? I mean, have you had any conversations?
Well, I think they saw the opportunity, and they saw a lost opportunity, and I think they thought, what the heck? Let's see if we can get more information, and I think they realized what they probably were losing, and they went back at it. I don't know all the details of their board or senior management decision there, but I knew they had a genuine interest in Wachovia from a strategic standpoint, and I just think they. The morning after, so to speak, things were going lightning quick through that weekend. They just realized, holy cow, I mean, a competitor just acquired this organization that we really want for $1 a share. And, let's rethink that. So.
Failure to buy remorse.
Right. Yeah, I think
buyer's remorse.
I think that had a lot to do with it, quite frankly. And,
one of the things we've heard, I don't know if I've seen this in a document, but that subsequent to September 29th anyway, that Wells got some kind of opinion that they'd be able to utilize tax loss carry forwards that they didn't think they'd be able to use otherwise. Do you know, have you heard anything like that or know anything about
that?
Yeah,
I mean, with our legal area, I mean, I was aware of requests they were making around, you know, ways to, you know, kind of both from a capital standpoint, et cetera, you know, get comfort on what the regulatory treatment would be for the deferred tax asset. I don't understand all the details to it. It's not unusual in complex transactions like that. Usually there's, you know, kind of Reg W, sometimes 23A issues, you know, when they're either a transfer of assets or whatever. I don't recall that really coming up. It might have been that, and there were several things. Capital, DTAs. Anyway, that there was something with lending limits as well. I just can't remember. But anyway, it was in that package of, okay, if we're going to do the deal, here's how the numbers work. Geez, we may need regulatory clarification on this, this, and this. I think it was in that vein that that the conversation occurred.
Okay. Earlier when I was asking you about, you know, conversations about whether Wachovia was too big to fail, your answer, as at least I heard it anyway, maybe I misheard it, was, you know, no, I don't remember that. In fact, we thought it was a strong bank. We in the FDIC, you know, agreed on a 3 rating, and I understand that. My question was a little different, though, not whether it was going to fail was in trouble, but just regardless of whether, given the size and interconnectedness of this institution, if it did get in trouble, you know, was there a belief or discussions within the OCC between you and folks outside the OCC of, look, if it ever happens, you know, Wachovia is not going to fail. It's too big. Sort of like back in 08, me being the fool said, ah, look at Citi, you know, I'm going to buy it at $4 a share because I know the government's not going to let them fail, and I think I'm still at about $4 a share. So
I was never involved or initiated any discussion that would have singled out Wachovia or, quite frankly, any others as too big to fail. I mean, certainly it's hard to envision some of these big ones fail in our system, but we never actively talked about Wachovia specifically, or quite frankly, the others. It's just they're just too big to fail, so therefore we'll adjust or tailor or look at them differently than others. I mean, it's not a. I understand the concept, but it's not one that we necessarily employ at all in our approach to supervision. I've been an examiner a long time. It's certainly a concept that's out there. We saw it play out where, you know, the government decided not to let them fail. But it was not anything strategy-wise that we ever, you know, kind of said we're going to do this and this and this because they're too big to fail.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something and ask you to comment on it from other folks we've talked to that have been in similar positions as you and maybe even here, but I think with the Fed.
Okay.
And have said, have told us that, you know, look, no institution, you know, is too big to fail when you're in a growing economy with stable markets. You know, the problem arises when you're not in a growing economy and you have disruptive markets, at which point, yes, he said, we all recognize that in those circumstances, there's a bunch of financial institutions out there that are too big to fail. And everybody knows that the government, or at least thought the government, would not let those institutions fail, with, of course, Lehman sort of being the big question mark out there that everybody's still trying to figure out why they were allowed to fail. So, I mean, can you comment on that? Does that...
I think that, you know, the decision to make sure there was a... as good a resolution as we could to Wachovia so that the markets would open with Wachovia not suffering as it was heading into the weekend, but coming out with some kind of, you know, solution at the end of the weekend, had everything to do about that institution being just, we could not afford to have a wounded duck like that laying out there. So, it clearly became a too-big-to-fail institution. And I think all up through the, in September there, you know, the Lehman thing, I think there was, I wasn't involved directly in them. I of some of what I've read and heard, but certainly there was a lot of discussion of whether, you know, it made sense to let Lehman unwind or not. And obviously the judgment was to let it unwind. AIG, the judgment was we got to support it. And I think after AIG, I think WaMu was tracking itself as an institution that was big, but kind of understood it was in dire straits, and I think didn't have some of the other complexities that a broader commercial bank has. That may have been a difference. Certainly was, quote, smaller than Wachovia. Like a Nat City, I wouldn't say a Nat City would have been too big to fail. You know, it's a large bank. It was smaller than WaMu. You know, Nat City had come to a failure. You know, I certainly was worried as a regulator that we were getting close to an institution that might, you know, lose its traction and go to receivership. But I was thinking of it going to receivership, not too big to fail. But I think the developing concern just was, you know, we've got to do what we can do here. And I think as subsequent to Wachovia, that's the whole TARP program changed, because TARP leading up to Wachovia was all about asset disposal, you know, somehow exchanging bad assets, collecting bad assets from firms to try to get the garbage off the balance sheet in hopes that what remained was good. And but there were so many complications around pricing that, the timeliness. I think after Wachovia, the learning was we got to come up with something that's much more surgical, that we can just once and for all stabilize the system, because we're, you know, the market just kept turning its guns on whoever was next on the list. And once Wachovia was taken, it was kind of like, okay, we're just going to go down this chain until the markets somehow change, and no one saw the point of what was going to change it. So I think the idea was, not to start keep singling out institutions as too big to fail. Let's just say the substantive market players, period, we're going to take care of once and for all. And I think the TARP capital injection was that play to eliminate this too big to fail one-off thing that was, you know, kind of introduced, I think, with those, what I call those September weekends.
Right.
And now we had Citi, you know, obviously come into play, but they had gotten the TARP, and we had to do more TARP. But at least we established a different mechanism that we actually learned from Wachovia for the subsequent transactions. Having gone through this thing, you know, these real big ones, you've got to have some way to handle those cleanly. And it is easier to close a smaller, less complex organization. So,
right.
So there was an idea of, you know, we're not sure what the combination here is, but we're not going to let them do. I think people learned from Lehman and were so panicked, we can't let another big one go that way. So I think I think the difference between WaMu and Wachovia is, you know, Wachovia was in a whole lot more different places than WaMu was. And WaMu was a more concise, granted big, but, you know, you could shut it down the way they did it.
So can you describe to me generally what your involvement was? I guess maybe not just that weekend, but at least including that Friday. We do know about the... Thought there was a Wells deal on Friday. Thought there was a Wells deal on Saturday.
Yeah.
Apparently folks woke up Sunday morning and found out no more Wells deal.
Yeah.
You know, the scramble to look at the city and Wells assisted bids. I think even Wachovia had a bid or a proposal in.
Yeah, they were trying to figure out some way they could engage the Fed in some kind of support just to buy time, more times what they were looking for, I think.
Right. And then we know that folks are staying up all night Sunday, and there's the FDIC board meeting at 6:30 in the morning, Monday the 29th, and the vote is made. So if you could, and I asked this of Mr. Wilson earlier today, we've seen the memo by the Richmond Fed, we've seen the memo by the FDIC. I haven't seen a memo by the OCC talking about whether or not the systemic risk exception should be invoked or anything like that. Is there anything similar to that?
Whether there's a memo.
Is there a memo or anything like a memo in this regard?
There's not a memo, and it's really our role, which is the first time this ever played out. We don't have, I mean, the controller has a vote as a member of the FDIC board on a systemic risk determination. So that's our, quote, our agency's formal. But our play in this is strictly to, when it involves a national bank, as it did with Wachovia and it did with Citibank, it's our assessment, and we're helping create a view and an understanding around the condition and the risk that institution poses, both to its own shareholders but to the broader market. And so we're really, we're not charged with creating a document per se that becomes an official record for action by the Board of Governors of the Fed or the FDIC board. Their memos are really created from input they gather from us as one key source. So no, we didn't have, I mean, we generated various spreadsheets and, a lot of it was phone calls, email traffic informing and working closely with the Fed and the FDIC, which actually worked extremely well both weekends. But but we didn't have to generate a formal document to feed the process.
So maybe that chart that I saw, the counterparties and the liabilities, probably came from you guys.
Yeah,
or at least
the
data came
from
you guys.
Yeah, all the expected credit loss that framed that framed a view on whether the Citi transaction made sense or not, whether the ring fencing concept made sense or not, all that was generated by our examiners on the ground.
So understanding that you're providing information to the FDIC and the Fed, and that there's not an official memo prepared, I mean, did the OCC, did you folks reach a determination or that, I know Mr. Dugan did because I've seen the minutes.
Right.
We shouldn't let this institution fail.
Yeah, we basically felt that it didn't make sense for this thing to fail. Our sense was that it an organization under severe stress, a transaction could be made here, so we should allow that to happen. So we supported that. We didn't oppose that or suggest a different alternative.
Did you have any discussions with anybody at the Fed or the OCC that weekend?
Regularly. I took the call from bank management on Friday evening, alerted the comptroller. We alerted the FDIC and the Fed. I did my counterparts. I led the briefing Saturday morning with Chairman Baer, along with Dave Wilson and Mike Brosnan. Was in constant communication with the Fed, the FDIC, Wells Fargo, Citibank on Sunday evening. Really, the only people I was not talking directly to were Treasury people.
I'm sorry, I know before you said that the call from Wachovia Management, I think, was the CFO and General Counsel.
That's correct.
I think you said.
Yeah.
And they called and said, what, as I'm looking for my notes?
They called to basically indicate that the board had met right before they called and decided.
I'm sorry, okay. Can we establish when the call was?
Oh, okay. The call was, I'd say, around 5:30 Friday afternoon on the 26th. And it was a call that I received in my office. I was joined by Julie Williams, our chief counsel. And I think that was at the request of Jane Sherburne, the bank's counsel. So Julie and I spoke with Jane Sherburne and Dave Swiner, who was the CFO of Wachovia, brand new CFO.
Right.
And they informed us of the board decision that based on the market activity that occurred on that Friday, they were concerned about their ability to fund operations through the following week, and that it was in the best interest of the institution to seek a partner. So they were opening up their data room. They had interested parties, City, Wachovia, and I think they were speculating a foreign entity that never developed, but there were three, if I recall.
You said City and Wachovia. I take it you
meant
Wells.
Wells, yeah, Wells. Sorry about that. And that, you know, they would be in touch, and, you know, we instructed them to keep us informed. I, subsequent to that, started my dialogue reaching the comptroller and then contacting my counterparts at the Fed and FDIC.
Okay. Any discussions with Sheila Bear by any chance?
Not directly. I did on Saturday morning, and basically what happened is the comptroller was actually overseas on his way back, so by email, I talked to him by phone, and then by email he gave instructions. He was communicating with his principal counterpart, so Sheila, I think Governor Warsh, Governor Cohn, and maybe Chairman Bernanke as well. I can't remember the full string, but anyway, his counterparts at the other agencies, Geithner at the New York Fed at the time, indicating, you know, great concern, you know, institutions under stress, you know, we'll do everything we can to work with the institution over the weekend. The Fed was alerted, so they were on the same grounding. And Chairman Bear asked early Saturday morning to be briefed on what we learned on Friday, what the updated condition of Wachovia was given Friday's events. So it was later that Saturday morning we actually held a conference call for her benefit, but invited the Fed as well to participate, and we discussed the condition of Wachovia. And then all through the weekend there were a number of different calls, different levels. Principals had calls. Principals and me and staff had calls. Staff had calls. So it was just a combination. Mm-hmm. Us with the banks, you know, without the banks. So it's just, you know, constant dialogue. And actually, it worked quite well. I mean, it just, you know, without any rehearsal, I mean, we were very much all tagged together. And quite frankly, all reached a similar assessment based on what we were looking at. So. So it wasn't, you know, it really wasn't, you know, at least at the staff level, there weren't any conflicts or major disagreements or major feelings of omission or, geez, you know, you guys got this wrong, or, you know, we came up with an estimated loss number looking at the credit portfolios at Wachovia. Everyone was kind of like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, we're all kind of there, so. So anyway, so it was, you know, a collaborative effort, but that's how we were involved in the thing.
Do you recall of the all the the numerous participants involved that weekend, was there anyone of the opinion of, no, we shouldn't invoke the systemic risk exception, we should do a least cost resolution liquidation?
The controller can give you a better sense of this, but I know, Chairman Baer had concerns about the FDIC incurring excessive cost in trying to assist the transaction in the way that it was being proposed. And I know there were conversations among the principals, several of which that I think went all the way up preceding the board meeting around that issue of trying to get her comfortable as to what ultimately became a no-cost solution to the FDIC. But it didn't start out with a common understanding that it was no-cost from her standpoint.
When you say ultimately a no-cost, you don't mean because of the Wells unassisted bid.
No, it was...
Because I've seen some reference in the board minutes that the Treasury was going to, which is a little odd since, FDIC. But anyway, the Treasury was going to cover the costs if there were going to be costs.
This is where the controller will have a better feel for this, but in my simple terms, the city transaction and the ring fence, you required the FDIC to play a role in ultimately, realizing some of the loss, but it was at such a catastrophic point with the first loss going to city, and then there was a $12 billion, over 3 or 5 year window of loss that city would take on top of that, that was supported by a preferred stock issued by city to the FDIC and to Treasury, that it was highly unlikely that you would ever get to that category. I mean, you'd have to have a world meltdown to get to that point. But I think Treasury agreed that if you got to that meltdown, we'll make sure the FDIC, it might have been Treasury to say, but then we'll take the first loss for the government versus the FDIC. So there was something like that. I don't know the details, but I think that's what's referred to.
Let me ask you something more general. In the research side of the FCIC, put together a narrative that I read a couple of days ago, and sort of going through institutions back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s that received government assistance because they were considered too systemically important to let fail. And perhaps not surprisingly, they all seem to follow the same pattern, right? I mean, leverage growth, risky assets, a lot of time real estate-based risky assets, short-term funding sources, right? And so when you see that, and that, although those institutions were not nearly as big as the institutions we were dealing with in late 2007 and throughout 2008, and of course, as the former bank examiner in me thinks, it's like, why do we let these institutions grow like this when we've seen this happen over the past? It's not 2020 hindsight. Yeah, yeah. We've seen this happen, and we know if the economy starts to decline and we're in a disruptive market that, there's a pretty good chance that we're not going to let them fail, and it's going to cost taxpayers and government money, et cetera, et cetera. So, and of course, you now have these four megabanks under your jurisdiction, not to mention the other 10 or 11. I mean, it is... I guess I just want you to comment on that. I mean, is it possible to prevent this kind of growth and to tell these banks you can't get this big, you can't fund yourself this way, you can't get in these kind of assets?
It's under that lessons learned. I think I know the answer is yes. It's the it becomes it's that balance between promoting a kind of a free market-based approach to the markets and allowing, institutions and management to be the market makers versus, the government, dictating the market thing. But with that said, what we've seen, which we've seen previously, and that's played out in different scale. So, the adjustments we make are going to have to be different. But high leverage, liberal underwriting, the risk management breakdowns, the lack of credible challenges by directors and senior management. Those are things we've seen before, small banks or large banks. We had an unprecedented run of prosperity, and we didn't do a good job intervening at key points in a way that would have influenced, without dictating market terms, would have influenced a different approach by the institutions. I mean, that's kind of our collective assessment. So what do we do about that? Certainly we're going to end up with higher capital, higher quality of capital standards, deeper asset liquidity, cash liquidity. Those won't in themselves prevent runs or crises in the future. They may mitigate, and it may take longer to get to the quick versus what we saw over the last couple of years. But we have to learn to intervene differently. So we have to have better information. The banks have to generate better information. So concentration management is important. Watching leverage of customers and the banks. The bank side will get taken care of with higher capital standards. But the borrowers, we've got to be careful, and pay closer attention to the leverage that a commercial retail borrower takes. So there were themes that we've seen in prior crises, but we underestimated what systemic risk really would be in the marketplace. We knew the world was more globally connected. We had no sense of how quickly investors would pull back and how that would play out in the marketplace. So I think, it's basically go back to the fundamentals, build the contingencies to reflect what the modern day, looks like versus, 20 years ago or so. And, I think that's going to be our effort while still trying to maintain an open marketplace kind of concept with the institutions.
But let me ask you, I mean, I get all that.
Mm-hmm.
But banks by nature are and always will be fairly leveraged. And
yep.
They're always going to be in the business of maturity transformation.
Right, right.
And so it seems that, and I don't know what the answer is. I've been struggling with this, and that's why I'm asking people like you to help me. Knowing that, and knowing that we now have, and in particular that you have, the biggest financial institutions in the world to deal with, or some of the largest institutions in the world to deal with, God forbid, and not that we're in a great economy now, but God forbid that, down the road we're in a disruptive economy again, and the Citis and the B of A's and the J.P. Morgans, are in a situation that Wachovia and Lehman and AIG were in in September of 08. And I'm just trying to figure out, if there is an answer, in a way to avoid a too-big-to-fail institution if we're in another disruptive market down the road, given the nature of banking.
Well, I think, we'll have to learn with this, but I think the tools that are introduced in the legislation, and I'm not an expert on them, but, the concept of, living wills, et cetera, their design is to try to create, it's not by law the same, but it's the PCA, the prompt corrective action concept that was introduced back in, was it?
91.
Is completely irrelevant for a large institution. I mean, it applies, but we blew right through that. None of these institutions were anything less than well capitalized by definition. but the funding was
right.
just like that. So, so the idea, I think, is we've got to create a different approach to understanding what we do when signs of stress show up. And, you know, part of it's the higher capital standards, higher quality of capital, more liquidity, that kind of thing. But it's also having a good idea of what that organization is and how to start, quote, unwinding it when things, but it's really getting them to do it versus us. But we ultimately use the tool of enforcement if we have to. Mm-hmm. And I think that, as well as the resolution authority granted to the FDIC for non-banks, non-insured banks, being a common receiver and a common focal point to resolve and execute these plans is the way to get at it, hopefully sooner. But it's an it's going to remain an untested mechanism, until it's experienced. But I think we'll work hard to try to define for each large institution a plan of attack. Should they come under severe stress beyond just the fundamentals. I mean, I think that's the approach. And then on the systemic risk standpoint is to try to be smarter about what the impacting risks are so that you can try to influence that for the broader group as quick as you can. And the Systemic Risk Council will single out individual institutions that are, more vulnerable than others, and either direct the agency who's responsible or agencies to do stuff quicker if necessary. So I think it's going to be that combination of thinking. Whether that ultimately, prevents that, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There are certainly people who are still skeptical that it will, but it's certainly a lot more than what we've had before. Mm-hmm. It's just whether it's enough.
Okay. I also wanted to ask you questions about Countrywide.
Okay.
I know we're getting late in the day.
I'm
happy
okay.
to keep going. I'm happy to do this another time if you guys.
No,
are.
We should finish
okay.
it. But does anyone want a restroom break?
I'm okay.
I'm okay.
Okay. Do you want to take a break anyway? Let's take a 5-minute break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that for Wachovia? Is that pretty much?
Just one real quick question. You had mentioned better management of concentration risk.
Yep.
Is there, recognizing, as Chris was saying, that financial institutions are inherently leveraged to begin with, is there a way to not thwart promoting free market versus managing a concentration that's 3 times or 4 times? I know the commercial real estate guidance, there was a lot of controversy arriving at 300%. But really, when you're so richly concentrated in one asset class, if there's a slight diminution or stress there, that's a multiple of capital that you might not be able to overcome.
Right, right.
So do you foresee a better management of concentrations feasible even when you have multiples of capital in, say, in like payment option arms or in leveraged loans or whatever asset class you pick?
I think I think the answer is we have to make it feasible. We have to, we may have to, and this is all undecided, but one of the things that we've started talking about is, whether we just hardwire limits, particularly for smaller banks, just say, we can get to it in the guidance, but you can't go over 300%, period. You'll be prohibited from that. But I think, for us, it's going to be part of it's getting it if there's concentrations requiring more capital immediately
and asset liquidity,
and if it's not there, you just basically tell them no and direct them no, and that'll be a change of behavior. It's just not the way supervisors have done that. I mean, extreme cases, there are examples where we've done that, but not as a general rule. It's whether we hardwire it or we try to get at it, and it's something we have to look at because it potentially has consequences when you start trying to restrict
credit extension,
right,
for example.
Intermediation credit, you create a process.
But I think the concept that we'll probably get at is, one, understand them, recognize them, and then put more capital and liquidity around them, and have the risk management tighter. If you can get that without creating hardwire rules, fine, but we may have to create some hardwire rules. But that's something for us to explore. And fortunately, in some of these large banks, you didn't have monstrous concentrations, like you see in smaller banks. Some smaller banks, commercial real estate concentration, 700-800% of capital, you didn't have anything like that in large banks. But you had large banks who had credit structure portfolios like CDOs that were huge concentrations to capital, maybe 100% of capital, but 100% was way outsized when you look at the risk and the nature of
valuation risk.
Yeah. So, we're pressing institutions now to really understand those things and wrap capital and liquidity around those things tightly. And they've learned that way. Doesn't mean that they can't pursue concentrations, but we're going to have to look at them differently.
Do you foresee that any of these changes would affect the way regulators view contributed capital? Because like in Countrywide, we saw in other institutions like GMAC, the parent is going to inject a capital, but it's not cash. Mm-hmm. It's like, we'll inject more auto loans, or we'll inject more super hybrid jumbo ARMs.
Yeah.
And what you have is more of a levering effect created versus protection against loss.
Yeah, I think, where you have real risk, we're going to require real capital. I mean, that's one of the simplicities that I think will come back into the game and substitute kind of ways of doing that. But it doesn't mean you may not ever have asset contributions or other valuable forms of support, but I think, a lot of this is where there's real risk, there's going to have to be real capital. And if there isn't, then you're going to have to diminish the activity, or you'll be highly criticized by the supervisors for it, and maybe mandated to raise more capital or something. So,
or your margin, so it's not 1-to-1.
Right. We're definitely heading to that world. It's just how prescriptive we give them that kind of thing. But we're starting with just fundamentally changing the definition of capital, which is getting closer to being decided upon, but it's really stripping out most things that aren't just common equity. It's going to gap for almost every institution a fairly sizable hole that's going to have to be filled in some way, raising capital, reducing leverage, both. Time will help. But it's creating a whole different discipline around it. So hopefully that stays for the long term, so we don't have crises to the magnitude we have. But it'll be interesting to see from the regulatory side how disciplined we are to really tightly wrap that. It's easier to do now because everyone's still licking the wounds, but.
Right.
How much of it gets hardwired and how much of it really impacts the environment and the economy, that's when the politics start playing out. We are supposed to stay high and dry in the politics as a supervisor. So,
5 minutes.
Okay. 5 minutes.